I'm Jonna Kaplan.
And I'm Carrie Provost, and you're listening to Going Steady,
a podcast about exploring places in the land of steady habits and beyond.
So people have been talking about the airport lately.
Bradley.
Or not Bradley.
Right. So they want to change the name of it. It seems very random.
It does. Right? Was this a problem that needed to be solved?
Right. I mean, I know it doesn't have a catchy city name in it, but when you buy things online, you kind of say where you're going and it redirects you.
Right. And many airports in this country are not named for their city. So I don't think that on its own should be a problem. This is one of those things that I get very steady habits about, I guess. Just why change something that's fine? Like, my brain does not need to learn a new airport code at this point. It's BDL is good enough, you know? Bradley himself, I don't think is problematic in any way.
There are times when it's really appropriate to change some names, and I have examples of that I can talk about later, but I think it seems awfully strange to do this. And if I'm working for the airport and trying to think about how to make it more attractive, that might not be my starting place as the name.
Well, I just saw that they are ending their nonstop flight to Vegas, which was seasonal to begin with. And that's one way to make yourself less popular. How about more nonstop flights to places we want to go? And like, your name doesn't matter. But I don't actually know if it's the airport authority that's in charge of this, or I don't know. But I know it's one of those things that everyone is kind of getting all caught up in and writing op-eds about.
Yeah, and I know there's a push for it to be called like the Hartford International Airport or something close to that.
I always thought that they did say, when you land, don't they say something like Hartford Springfield something,
right?
Something.
Well, and that's what they would have to say is Hartford Springfield, because it's not right next to Hartford.
It's kind of, I always feel bad for people on that plane who might think they're flying into Hartford or Springfield because they don't know they have to drive through a tobacco field first.
Yeah, and I would say that would be one of the improvements to make, would be better connection. Like, what happens to you once you get off the airplane? Not everyone's going to rent a car, and you might think, I can just go and get on the bus.
Yeah, that would be one thing. Like, a train directly there from everywhere with the train station would be, you know, a nice little touch that would help the airport. But I don't know. It's like, well, the other thing that's the controversy at the moment is Still Revolutionary, our tourism slogan, which is another thing that I guess the new Lamont staff, people who've been assigned to this, I don't know if it's like some commission, they don't like this. They don't understand it, apparently. And this is another one that I'm like, leave it. It's 5 years old. It's a five-year-old slogan. As I understand it, tourism has gone up since it was instituted. Not because of that, probably, but you know, I don't see, like, I kind of liked it. Did you like Still Revolutionary when they rolled it out?
When they first rolled it out, I thought it was kind of silly. But when they started to actually make the connection to the Revolutionary War,
I thought I was going to hate it, because it's hard to come up with a good tourism slogan. I mean, Rhode Island's is Fun Size, which is so cheesy.
Oh, that's sad.
That's sad.
And I think that's part of our ongoing issue for Connecticut is, what should we be known for?
Right. And so this is why I liked Still Revolutionary, is I think it ties together what people do know us for, which is the combination of the historic and the kind of invention, innovation, higher end stuff. And that's why people come here for the most part. They might not think of it in those terms, but either they're coming for like some fancy hotel, or they're coming for, you know, colonial era history, old towns, and so on. So I thought that, surprisingly, for an out-of-state firm that came up with it, you know, they got it, so give it some time.
Right. It's better than just defaulting to the insurance capital of the world, which is like, can we get more vanilla than that?
Can we
get more boring?
Well, what is Massachusetts? I don't even remember. They might have changed it. I think it is or was. It's all here, which could be literally any state.
All of it. It's all here.
It's all here. Like, maybe not all, but
no.
Yeah, this just annoys me. It's like messing with, I mean, at some point since the 60s, someone in Virginia must have been like, Virginia is for lovers. What is that? Let's change it. But they didn't. And now we all know that. Everyone knows that. I Heart New York. You need to give these things a few decades to sink in, especially with Connecticut, which people from elsewhere don't know anything about it.
Okay, so if they change Bradley or don't change Bradley, we know that people are creatures of habit, and we're going to still call it Bradley.
True.
Forever, just like the Hartford Civic Center is the Civic Center and not the Excel Center to me, or the Meadows Music Center. I don't know what they even currently call that because it's been so many iterations. Sometimes that generic name, not that Bradley's generic, but like the starting point is not the worst one necessarily.
Yeah, if a thing has a silly name or a boring name, but people love it, the name does not matter, right?
Right. So I did some research on this place in Hartford, and this isn't a tourism issue, but a place called Dauntless Lane, which is amazing. And I found out it wasn't about being dauntless, but named after the ship, the Dauntless,
which had
a tie to Hartford. So yeah, very cool and different than just naming it after a person or, you know, the generic Main Street, whatever. And so now it is Woodland Drive. And the best I could make out of this was that, so now I think it's Hartford Housing Authority, like, you know, public housing. But decades ago, there was a management company there that had pretty publicly in the newspapers spoken, they had been critiqued for not having good enough lighting, locks, and such on their buildings. And there were several sexual assaults in a short period of time. Because it was so easy to get into the buildings. And it looked like after a few years of that, they decided, you know, we need to change the name of our street because that's going to be the way to get our reputation back. That's the best I could make of it. I'm kind of hype, you know, putting some things together in clues. And there's big gaps in, I don't know, what they suggested ended up being changed a little bit. And then somewhere in there, they are no longer the management company of the place. But going from something Dauntless Lane to something that's otherwise kind of generic seemed like such a loss. And especially given that, and they couldn't have known that at the time, now we can search everything on the internet and we can find out that that was still the location. You know, still revolutionary, if whatever that next iteration is, if they change it, we're going to still know that the slogan was at one point still revolutionary.
In the same way that we still remember that it used to be full of surprises, which actually cracks me up. Because I think it's literally true. Connecticut is full of surprises, but I understand that it's like not the most flattering. It's ambiguous, shall we say.
Yes, because surprises are not always positive.
Right. But actually that street name reminded me of the also pretty recent mini controversy in New Britain when they wanted to change Paul Manafort Drive, I think it was, to Paul Manafort Sr., Drive to avoid any suggestion that they might have wanted to commemorate Paul Manafort Jr., which I do understand.
What would help Connecticut's tourism if it's not as simple as just fixing a slogan up? What do you think would be some things that we could do to make?
I don't know. This is hard. I mean, I'm not a tourism expert, but I always with Connecticut, I just go back to the self-esteem issue. Right. I think so much begins with people from the state taking pride in it. Because I know that when I was young and I really didn't know much about Connecticut at all, except that I lived here and I didn't like it. And I was basing that on one town because I never went anywhere else. And people from elsewhere would ask me, what's in Connecticut? And I'd just say nothing. And I think we've all probably done that, at least yeah. When we were younger. There's an Instagram account, or maybe it's a blog too, but it's called Maine Sucks, and it's purely ironic. It's like these people, I always talk about Maine too, because people from Maine friggin' love Maine, but it's just gorgeous photographs, and the captions are like, man, Maine sucks so bad, you know, and it's like some beautiful, like, sunset in the park, I don't know. So I think we need a bit of that, and then it kind of goes outward, like if people who live here are traveling and talking up how great it is, that certainly would help. Or it's random, like Gilmore Girls. Who would have thought that hundreds, thousands of people would travel to some town with very little actually in it because of some random TV show? You know, you can't always control all these things.
So I was just in Niantic earlier and I saw some street signs with the scallops on them. That's adorable. It takes up very little space. It doesn't make it any less readable.
There's a lot of that, like town pride or like town really local identity. I don't know that it translates.
Right. And so, and technically that's a village. So mm-hmm. if anyone who's a purist about these things is listening. Yeah. But I also saw like in No Ink, you have the anchors.
Yes.
Everywhere.
Yes. Can I tell you a story about the No Ink with the anchor sign?
I want to know more about this.
So I don't actually know where it originated, but I don't know if anyone, like if you've seen these, it's like a bumper sticker or a sticker. And it's basically just an anchor in one of those circles with a slash through it. And I saw these for years probably. And I thought it was some kind of like protest against fishing or protest against the Navy base. I was so confused. And finally, somebody told me it's No Anchor. And I was like, oh. Even people who live a few miles from No Ink don't necessarily know that that's what that means. So it's definitely there. I think we have potential for an identity. We just right. don't try hard enough.
I spent a lot of time thinking about transportation, making it easier so that you're not having to rely on a car. And I wonder, why don't we have better train service and then some little shuttles that come out from the train stops and know that like, transportation could just be so much easier without that much fuss.
I'm sort of two minds about that sort of improvement. I mean, I'm all for it. Better transportation in every way and making things more convenient for people. But I also think that tourism, just having gone to touristy places all over the country, like that's not necessary to get huge crowds of people. Right. The things that people will put up with are really quite amazing when something is popular and they want to see it. I wouldn't put up with it myself.
Yes.
But people will absolutely sit in traffic. They will park in all sorts of inconvenient places. That's why, you know, when people complain about parking in Hartford, which right. I do too, especially when they don't clean the 2 inches of ice off the street and you're trying to parallel park and you can't because the spaces that are left are like little ice balls. A lot of people will go, oh my gosh, anywhere, like, and deal with crowds and deal with lines. So
that's true.
I don't know. I almost feel like if we got millions more tourists to Connecticut, maybe then would be the time to get on people about increasing shuttles and train service. And
people who have options, or they'll just put up with it and take a car. But I'm wondering, like, for people who don't have a lot of money but still want to get to certain things, it might be nice to have some other
I think
options.
Most visitors to Connecticut are either staycationing or people from like New York. It's right. not a whole lot of people traveling from far away to come here. It's much more percentage-wise people who come from nearby. So in that sense, it does, it would be nice, I guess, for people coming from New York or Boston who don't have cars to make that a little easier.
If Bradley had to change its name, what would you prefer?
Oh, I don't know. It would be just funny if they called it Windsor Locks International Airport. That would just confuse everybody outside of Connecticut.
Windsor where?
What's a lock? What?
I'd vote for the very lengthy, like, Southern New England Airport and just let people try to figure out what that even means, since we know from maps that sometimes Connecticut's not even in the New England map.
Yeah, the acronym would be SNE.
So, kind of speaking of transportation, I wanted to talk about something that you know much more about than I do, at least judging from some of your photos. So the covered bridges, I've always thought of them as being kind of this cute throwback. And the only one I can even tell you a location about is the covered bicycle pedestrian bridge in Andover. And that's new. And that's all I've got. So what can you tell us about like covered bridges? Like, why are they covered? Why not just keep them open? And why did we stop building them?
So covered bridges, I feel like they're associated with New England frequently, right? But they're not a particularly New England structure. They're all over the Northeast and the Midwest and some other parts of the country. The first one in America was built in Philadelphia. The oldest one that's still around, I guess, is in New York State. I looked this up, and apparently Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana have more each than a lot of New England states do. And that movie, Bridges of Madison County, which I never saw, is set in Iowa. Apparently there's 6 covered bridges in real life in that county. And I looked at the pictures, and ours are prettier, I have to say.
That's probably why we have the association.
Right, because ours are prettier. Maybe they are. So Connecticut has 3. I saw an otherwise good post on the New England Historical Society website that says Connecticut has 90 covered bridges, which is crazy. And I know where they got it from. There's this list that has every covered bridge, including like ones that were built in 2004, ones that are decorative on private property, in shopping center parking lots.
Oh, no.
That kind of thing.
Those don't count.
No, they do not count. So our 3, just really quick, are the Comstock Covered Bridge in East Hampton and Colchester. That's the pedestrian-only one. Mm-hmm. That's really fun because you can walk in it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Bull's Bridge in Kent, which is the long, scary-looking one. And the West Cornwall Covered Bridge in Cornwall and Sharon, and that's the pretty red one. Those are single-lane vehicular traffic, so you have to do the scary thing where you let the other car go and you wait, and you're like, is anybody coming? Am I going
to
die?
Yes, you have to trust the society to behave.
Yes, and these are, you know, the authentic George Washington fell in the river here type of bridge. But other New England states have a lot more than we do. Vermont has the most. They have supposedly over 100. They also have a museum about them in Bennington. I'm not that into them that I would go there, but New Hampshire also has quite a few. Rhode Island has none left, and they have one that they promote, but it was built like, I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago. Rhode Island. Massachusetts, like us, they have a handful. And of course, some of these are reconstructions or replicas because they don't last forever. And that's actually why they're covered. It's just to protect the wood from the elements. So there's a lot of sort of mythology about them, like that people, they're for like privacy for couples who want to stop in there and kiss and like stuff like that. And I've also seen references to a kiss being considered a toll to cross the bridge, or like 18th, 19th century guys kind of stopping the wagon in the bridge to like kiss the girl when nobody's watching. But it's kind of implied that like it's not with her consent. Ew. Which is like, oh, happy Valentine's Day, everyone. Just like that puts a kind of gross like spin on the whole mythology. There's also a lot of them that are said to be haunted, of course.
Probably by the women who were kissed without consent.
Right. They never say that, of course. And then I did see once, although it's not a New England specific reference, that robbers would hide inside the bridge and just like lie in wait for people passing through to rob them. I don't know if that's true or if it's kind of fear mongering of the day. They are, I think, really popular now as tourist attractions just because they're so pretty. And I think have we talked about this before on here, how like fashion bloggers are always posing in front of them like about to get hit by a car.
Saw recently, I think it was the East Hampton Bridge you had a picture of with the snow.
Yeah, I love that one because it's pedestrian only. It used to be like a road, but they closed that at some point. So yeah, I took that picture and then I like ran under there to hide my camera from the precipitation. That's a really pretty bridge. It's in the Salmon River State Forest, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's just a really pretty area. I feel like the other two are kind of more famous, if you will, because they're in Western Connecticut.
Right. I've seen pictures of at least the Kent. I haven't been through it.
I've only been through it once, and it's a little scary, actually, because it's long. I mean, and that it's a very authentic experience, except authentically you wouldn't be in a car. So it would be a little less scary. But yeah, that's a long one. And those both are also in pretty areas generally. So definitely worth going to see. You know what else? There are 3 that I could think of, but I know there are more in some of our state parks. They have not so much the historic covered bridges, but very pretty ones built probably in the 60s or 70s. Mm. Chatfield Hollow has one, and Devil's Hop Yard, and Southford Falls, I think. And there's a few more. But those are quite nice because, you know, you're already in a state park. So that's like a very pastoral little scene for you.
Right.
Know?
We've been talking for a while about different kinds of travel books or travel guides that we gravitate toward, and we keep saying we're going to talk about this, but we needed time to refine our lists.
So we made lists of our top five, right? Travel books.
Yeah, I had five and then a bonus because I couldn't be limited and me I could too. Have kept me going.
Too. I had a tie. So do you want to tell me about your number one and then we'll alternate?
So I would say I have a very clear top one, and then the rest of them I would say all sort of tie together as being in the top tier of things.
That's kind of like mine too. That's funny. Yeah.
So this book, Looking for Alaska by Peter Jenkins. I've read it probably five times. It's not a guide. It's just like his own story about traveling around up there, and it has kind of a journalistic tone to it, so you get the sense of what he's seeing and how he's interacting with different people, and it's not just all about him, so that was appealing to me.
My top one is a classic that should be even more of a classic, Black Lemon, Gray Falcon by Rebecca West, and it was published in 1941. She's obviously a very highly acclaimed journalist and writer in many genres, and today, I feel like she's best known for those few cutting feminist quotes that often show up on quote lists. And this book has a lot of that brilliance and feminism too, but it has so much more. It's basically her travels through Yugoslavia leading up to World War II, and her descriptions of places and people are just absolutely beautiful. The way she fits her experience of travel into the politics of the moment. You could read it as sort of a political history type book, but you could also read it purely as a travelogue. She's really funny. She snarks at all the Germans she meets that we now know, and they can tell even then will soon be Nazis. There's just great descriptions of like the people that she travels with and stays with, the food, everyone she meets, just an absolutely, the kind of book that inspires you to want to travel, but also makes you want to sit on your couch and just wrap yourself in a blanket and eat some kind of Balkan pastry and read that book all weekend. So yeah, that's definitely my number one.
Sidewalks, A Journal for Exploring Your City by Kate Pokras, probably saying everyone's names wrong. It's an interactive journal. I like it because if you're someone who isn't used to spending time alone or noticing things, it gives you ways to get into that. So it guides you. There's a page that gives you a pictorial guide to ways of walking. Another page or two is dedicated to hunting down international desserts, and they have...
That sounds really cute. Okay, so my number two is the Lewis and Clark journals, and anyone who knows me will be like, of course, and we'll link to all of these, but I'm thinking of the version that's edited by Bernard DeVoto, so it's not the huge 10-volume journals with everything in it, but it's very easy to read. Lewis and Clark have been called the writingest explorers ever, and that's, I think, true. They're brilliant. They're often funny, intentionally and not intentionally. A lot of the books on my list, I guess, were kind of like, had some impact on my life, and this was not the book that made me think I could write about travel, but it was probably the book that made me actually like abandon my whole life and move to St. Louis and start writing professionally many years ago. Yeah, I think a lot of people talk about Lewis and Clark and they think they know this story, but they've clearly never read this. And I think it's just a really important piece of American history and probably would be surprising to people that don't know it. And also just highly entertaining. It's like action, really, you know, chased by bears and scavenging for food. And like, it's just really fun to read and everyone in it. And it's not just Lewis and Clark, of course, it's like a whole group of people working together, and the personalities are just really kind of surprisingly endearing. And if you don't want to read this book, watch the Ken Burns documentary because it's beautiful and it's just an important story.
I haven't read either of those yet, and now I'm making my list of books to read longer. But this one, I don't know if this made your list, but I know you have read this, and I couldn't pick one specifically, but the WPA state guides.
Oh, that didn't
just
make my
as
list.
As a whole.
Yes, oh my gosh, 100% cosign.
Is even though wow, it's so much propaganda, but I love it so much because of the descriptive writing. So I found the Connecticut one seems so obvious, so I pulled a Michigan one. But this is a few things that someone or a few people had to say about Michigan. So this is from the WPA State Guides. So, born in bloodshed, dissension, sharp dealing, and common courage, elements existing in all our frontiers, Michigan's place in the national contemporary scene has been won by a series of physical and tonal changes that in their variety and clarity have made the state, not one but many, have given it not one but half a dozen histories, and have stroked a painting at today's point in its development as one of fascinating and complicated character. And then, you know, they go on to talk about, this other passage. It kills me. Outstanding beneficiaries of this climactic largesse are the counties of the Lower Peninsula that lie along the Lake Michigan watershed. The prevailing westerly winds, tempered in passage over Lake Michigan, blow cooler in summer and milder in winter, thus admirably adapting the climate to the cultivation of a great fruit belt. So all of this makes it sound like this is the place where you're going to find the best of everything, and they might have some mention of a shortcoming somewhere, but they know how to like turn it around and really polish.
They are the best. I've only read the Connecticut one, and I have tried to do a bunch of the they split it into, actually, I don't know if every state is the same, but the Connecticut one is split into, they do cities and then towns, and they do some little road trips. And I've tried to do some of the little road trips. And of course, the landscape is quite different now, but some of them are so wildly off that I came to the conclusion that the writers were drunk the whole time, which makes me like them even more. That would be a great present if someone was moving to another state. Get them the WPA travel guide. My number three is Great Plains by Ian Fraser. He writes for the New Yorker, and I actually like his travel books far more than his current New Yorker stuff. The book was published in 1989. It's basically just him driving by himself around the Great Plains for years, and it's just a great mix of what it's really like to be alone on the road for long stretches of time, what it's like to be kind of on a quest for something and you're not exactly sure what, but you can only find it by driving around America, and the history of a lot of these places, and just sort of forgotten history and forgotten places in many senses, because, you know, it's not the Midwest, it's not the Far West, it's the Great Plains, and it's kind of spectacular for what it doesn't have. It's this sort of featureless, huge swath of the country that is not featureless at all once you get there. But yeah, that was like one of the first travel books that I really loved.
A recent one that I just finished, and I should have written down the author's name, but it's called Alone Time. So it's set up in four sections plus an intro, four sections by season and in different cities. And the author begins with this pretty solid introduction, making the case for not just solo travel, but spending time by yourself. And then she writes about her travels. The first section is in Paris. As much as I don't necessarily go to a place for food, she writes really well about her experience in extremely fancy restaurants, dining solo, and the kind of treatment she got, which was usually really excellent, actually. I'll say it's kind of tied with, because I have a bonus one, but it's kind of tied with another recent one that I read, Tide, Feather, Snow, A Life in Alaska by Miranda Weiss, which is a woman who grew up in like inland Maryland and went up to Alaska and is sort of adapting. I think it's an interesting counterbalance to looking for Alaska.
I bought that Alone Time book because you recommended it. Yes. I haven't started it yet.
So my bonus is Coney Island Lost and Found by Charles Denson, which is very photo heavy.
My number four is The Road to Oxiana by Robert Byron, another English 1930s travelogue, coincidentally, but it's pretty different in some ways, I guess, to my first one, and similar in other ways. He's traveling through the Middle East and Central Asia, so many of today's hotspots. Robert Byron was this young British, Eton and Oxford educated guy, and you'd think he would be unbearable, but he's curious and really compassionate and absolutely hilarious. This book is just very funny and There's only a few travel writers I like who don't use humor, and he definitely does. He has very intellectual interests. He actually goes on this trip ostensibly to look for some Persian king's mausoleum or something. It's like obscure architecture that nobody else is into, but he really avoids being a snob unless it's funny. He's like punching up before that was a thing, kind of snarking on the English. And it's more importantly, it's a look at a world that's pretty much gone now, I think, or at least extremely changed. It was published in 1937, and there's a little map in the front, and it's like half those countries aren't there, or they have different names, or I don't really ever hear anyone talking about this book, but I love it.
It was hard for me not to put anything by Bill Bryson on the list, even though I enjoy his work, but I think some other things have like floated up.
Yeah, I used to like him more, but he is funny. My initial number five was This Cold Heaven by Gretel Ehrlich. She spends 7 years going back and forth to Greenland and just sort of immerses herself in this extremely different, she's American, immerses herself in this culture, climate, language, way of life. It's a very poetic book, just the way she writes. It's very personal, but it's also quite elusive. There's not much that's revealed, and it weaves in stories of Arctic explorers of the past and a lot of interviews with modern inhabitants and just her own travel experience and very detailed descriptions of the landscape and the lifestyle of the people there. But it kind of all feels very dreamlike. One reason I love it is because to me, what she does is so scary. We've talked about like being afraid of everything and that kind of extreme isolation for part of a year in a place with either all sunlight or all darkness. And she goes there initially to kind of heal from the aftermath of an accident. And so it's like to be dealing with like some kind of, and she's vague about that too, although she did write a previous book about the accident that she had, but just like dealing with some health thing and being in a place where you don't speak the language, and she lives with people who, locals, and hunts with them and goes out on the ice with them. And it's just fascinating. And then my other number five, which I couldn't not put in here, another classic, Blue Highways by William Least Heat Moon. And I haven't read it for years, so I'm not entirely sure how much of it would still be relevant. But when I read it in the mid-2000s, I guess, for the first time, it was still seemed very relevant then. And it's basically just a celebration of like solo travel, backroads travel. It's got a lot of history, a lot of like weird place names and how they came to be. And he talks to lots of weird characters, and he's kind of a weird character, and he lives in a van. And this is the kind of writing that I think was once much more common and is now pretty much gone. And maybe if it wasn't gone and if more people were allowed to write and read books like this now, we wouldn't be in this situation post-election of 2016, where we had to send like van loads of New York reporters out to the Midwest to interview racists in diners, because we would understand the country better because we would be reading travel writing.
There are a few Patreon supporters who we would like to thank: Allison, Anthony, Benjamin, Brian, Constanza, H.S., Margo Lynn, Mary, Matthew, Nancy, and Steve.
Your support helps Going Steady keep going steady. Thank you.
You can now listen on the Apple Podcasts app, iTunes, and Stitcher. If you'd like to rate or review us over there, that would be a great help. You can also subscribe to Going Steady and receive notifications by email. Sign up at goingsteadyct.com. That's goingsteadyct.com. Comments, suggestions for future episodes, hit us up at goingsteadyct.com.